This podcast is brought to you by the GOSH Learning Academy.
Hello, and welcome to Master the MRC PCH. In this series, we tap into the expertise here at Great Ormond Street Hospital to give you an overview of a topic on the RCPCH exam curriculum. So whether you're revising for an exam or just brushing up on a need-to-know topic, hopefully this podcast can give you the information that you need. I'm Dr. Sarah Ahmed, a paediatric registrar and the current Digital Learning Education Fellow here at GOSH. In today's episode, we're going to be talking to Dr. Mary Mathias, a consultant haematologist and the Haemophilia Centre Director at Great Ormond Street Hospital. We're going to be talking about haemophilia, covering etiology, diagnosis, management, prognosis and complications. This corresponds to learning outcomes in the haematology and oncology section of the MRCPCH exam curriculum. This is part two of our episode on haemophilia. Last week we covered presentation, pathophysiology and diagnosis, and this week we're going to cover management, complications and prognosis. So if we're moving forward in that patient journey, so you have a patient, you've diagnosed them with haemophilia, how would you go about managing them?
So again, it gets back to how severe is the haemophilia. So I'll start with the sort of the good end, if you like, the easy end. So mild haemophilia, so that's a level of 6 IU per deciliter and above. Most of those boys don't need any regular treatment. So they would need treatment around surgery, around dental extractions, for example. If they had a significant injury, so, you know, we would react to fell over and banged head or, you know, broke arm by giving them some of the missing clotting factor. And that's given as an intravenous injection, either factor 8 or 9. And so our children who've got factor 8, 9 levels between 6 and say 20-ish, we would give them an emergency dose of treatment to have at home. And that's partly in our practice because we don't have an A&E. They would be going to a local hospital, calling us for advice, and we would be asking the local teams to administer that factor if necessary. Obviously, around the country, there are different setups, and say, you know, Manchester Children's Hospital, mostly the children would pitch up there and be treated by the sort of bleeding disorders team. So it varies around the country. Yeah. Very occasionally, those patients need more regular treatment, but that is an exception. Okay. Moderate haemophilia, so levels between 1 and 5. If you'd asked 20 years ago, most clinicians would say they don't need regular treatment. Their levels are above 1. They mostly don't bleed. That really is not the case. It wasn't the case 20 years ago. But I think it's recognised that it's not the case now. And the majority of children in the UK now with moderate haemophilia will be on regular preventative treatment, which is called prophylaxis. You know, if their levels are closer to 1, almost certainly their levels closer to 5, some of them really don't bleed.
Yeah.
Our cutoff point is any child that has had a joint bleed, even if it's associated with some injury, we would be talking to the family about starting regular treatment.
Okay.
So the aim of prophylaxis for haemophilia is to prevent intracerebral bleeding and death. That is number one. And I think sometimes we forget to say that.
Yes.
Fortunately, intracerebral bleeding is relatively rare, but it is still the commonest cause of death in untreated haemophilia, based in the UK and around the world, where obviously treatment is largely not available. So that is why we start treatment. We talk a lot about joint health.
Yeah.
Actually, it's to keep these boys alive.
Mm-hmm.
The second reason is to prevent intra-articular joint bleeding, which leads to hemarthroses, recurrent hemarthroses, and essentially to early arthritis and very disabling arthritis changes. Mm-hmm. So the natural history, which I've really talked about, but if you take somebody with severe haemophilia who is born in the UK 100 years ago, the natural history of severe haemophilia was a life expectancy of less than 20 years. Likely cause of death would be intracerebral hemorrhage or some other exsanguination event, either associated with trauma or a dental extraction. But for those who survive even that or longer, they were all extremely disabled. So fixed flexion deformities in all of their major joints, so unable to straighten elbows, knees. And obviously, you know, I'm talking about the movement element of that, but clearly incredibly painful.
Yes.
And if anybody is interested as a sort of historical snapshot, if you look at you Google pictures of the last Russian Tsar's son, who obviously...
Alexei
obviously had the best care available, which was nothing. And if you look at his pictures, they're all of him in his uniform, leaning on something with his bent elbow, looking martial, but he's leaning on his bent elbow because he can't straighten his elbow and his knees are bent. And that's the sort of classical picture of hemophilia, even in somebody, you know, with the best care in the world. Because they didn't really have any care. Obviously, he did not die of his hemophilia. Yeah. But a number of that very extended family, because the gene was through the Spanish royal family as well. And the affected men, a number of them died as a result of bleeding. So that's why we give prophylaxis.
And by prophylaxis, do you mean prophylactic factor?
So until very recently, yes, that's exactly what I meant. And there was no other alternative. So both hemophilia A and B, the standard of care was and is for hemophilia B to give a replacement of the protein that's missing. So regular injections of factor 9, which would have been once or twice a week, or factor 8, which would be 2 to 3 to 4 times a week, depending on which factor you use. So it has to be given intravenously. And obviously in children who may be starting that prophylaxis at the age of 3-4 months or even at birth, that involves a central line. From 2019 onwards, we have been able to prescribe a monoclonal factor 8 mimetic. This is only for hemophilia A, called emicizumab, or the trade name is Hemlibra. That's given subcutaneously. Initially, there's a loading dose for a month, once a week, and then it's usually once every 2 weeks or once a week, again, depending on a little bit size. So is one or other better? Jumping in, assuming your question, the answer is we don't know for sure. Nobody's ever done a randomized controlled trial and nobody ever will.
Yeah.
What we do know is that both of them, when given well and effectively, are extremely good at preventing bleeding. So I have patients on factor 8 prophylaxis who don't bleed at all. Mm-hmm. And I have patients on emicizumab who don't bleed at all. And I have both who do.
Yes.
The benefit of the emicizumab is obviously a giant reduction in the treatment burden. Mm-hmm. So no need for central access in the younger kids. It's subcutaneous. You don't have to carry around, you know, all the palaver involved with an IV infusion. What it does is to create a steady state effect once it's loaded.
Mm.
And it's equivalent to having mild hemophilia. So okay. It is not a cure. It's not a fix. But it, if you like, it lifts the bar from no hemostatic effect to that equivalent to a factor A of about 15, for example. And most boys with a factor 8 level of 15, I will speak to them or their parents once a year. They'll call us if they have a problem, but they don't need regular treatment.
Okay.
So, you know, however, there's always a however. If you have severe hemophilia and you are on that monoclonal Hemlibra, you will still need additional doses of factor if you have a significant trauma. And what is significant? So it can be playing a game of football.
Yeah.
It can be a bad tackle. So that boys with mild hemophilia will need treatment for those kinds of injuries. And that is still true of somebody severe on Hemlibra. And that's fine for a lot of my patients. So, you know, their parents or they as teenagers could treat themselves if they need a top-up dose. But it's more complex in a toddler if all they've ever had is that monoclonal, which is fantastic because no port, it worries about infection. But the difficulty we're seeing then is that 2, 3, 4 year old who falls over, bangs their head, needs an extra dose, the parents can't treat.
Hey,
and
yes.
So they are then having to go to accident and emergency, interact with that, you know, urgent medical care situation, which even more than usual at the moment is very challenging, be confronted by the team in A&E who probably have never met somebody with hemophilia, don't know a huge amount about it. And even with phone calls with us and so on, what we're seeing is really long waits to get that treatment. Whereas for us, our standard of care, you know, child falls over, bangs head, is parent rings, give them another dose, job done, worry over. So there are pros and cons with the new treatment. It has been an amazing step forward for many people, but it's not without its issues. For hemophilia B, at the moment, we don't have any licensed prophylaxis other than factor 9. But there are a few monoclonals coming down the track through a clinical trial.
So watch this space.
Yeah.
You spoke a little bit about prognosis 100 years ago. What's the prognosis now for a child who's got hemophilia?
So again, just to tease apart, the milder the condition, the less impact it would have on anything to do with sort of survival. And, you know, there are men issues, mild haemophilia is picked up when they're 20 or 30.
Wow.
Because they have a tooth sac. So the milder the condition, the less impact it will have. In terms of the sort of the other end, the severe end, now we would expect a normal life expectancy for a child born in the UK with severe haemophilia.
Okay.
Now, again, it's less about the condition itself, but clearly, as with anything in medicine, if you have an underlying condition and then additional problem on top of it, the interaction of those two issues can make things more complex.
Yeah.
One of the things I haven't mentioned, and I think it's probably just worth doing so briefly, before we had the monoclonal to treat factor VIII, one of the biggest problems we dealt with in haemophilia care in pediatrics was the emergence of antibodies against factor VIII.
Okay.
When you start treatment. So you're taking a child who makes none of their own factor VIII, and you're exposing them to external factor VIII. So, you know, even fairly basic immunology will suggest that some people are going to make an antibody against factor VIII. And that happens about 30% of boys with severe haemophilia A. It's much rarer in haemophilia B. Those antibodies are called inhibitors. And don't ask me why, it's just how it evolved. But I mean, it makes sense, because what happens if you then give that child factor VIII and measure their level 20 minutes later, it's zero. So you don't need to have much of an antibody response to make factor VIII totally null. So before we had this new monoclonal, which gets around this problem, we had to try and get rid of those inhibitors by basically flooding the child's system with giant doses of factor VIII, so giving it much more frequently in much bigger volumes. I don't need to say anything further about that at the moment, but that was a big problem for us. It is no longer such a worry because of this amazing monoclonal, which was developed actually to treat patients with inhibitors. It also works for the people who don't have an inhibitor, but that has taken, because it prevents bleeding to a huge extent, that's taken the big worry away from us about inhibitors. But there are still patients out there, adults and teenagers and even younger children, who have those antibodies. And whilst the Hemlibra is great preventative care, if I flash forward to some of the children I look after with current inhibitors, they're not bleeding. But when they're 40, if they develop an additional medical problem, you know, they need treatment for a cancer, they have a major road traffic accident and need, you know, reconstructive surgery, plastic surgery, that is going to be a big problem for them. So I think, you know, that there are, I could see situations where an ongoing underlying inhibitor would definitely have an impact on morbidity and mortality in later life.
Yeah.
But that would be for the minority.
This has been unbelievably fascinating. I feel like haemophilia is something that you learn about for the exams, you know about in theory. Like you said, it comes up at GCSE and it comes up in history. But actually doing a bit of a deep dive into it has been just so, so interesting.
Only other thing just to throw in, because we're talking about history, is a slightly more recent history than the Russian royal family. And I think it's really important, not just around haemophilia, but around the use of blood and blood products to treat children and adults generally.
Yes.
And this is around the infected blood inquiry. And many people will have come across that in the news lately, and because the report of a 5 or 6 year inquiry has been released earlier this year. So from a haemophilia point of view, in the 1980s and 1990s, a huge proportion of patients who required treatment with clotting factors, which were at that point derived from donated blood, were infected with hepatitis C, a slightly smaller proportion hepatitis B, and a very significant proportion with HIV.
Yeah.
And without trying to give a precise number, roughly 50% of the men and boys with severe haemophilia A at that time who were infected with HIV died. So it has had a giant impact on everything to do with haemophilia care throughout the world. This is not a UK thing. This is a worldwide thing. And I think anybody who comes across with their work and practice, a family with an inherited bleeding disorder, not necessarily just haemophilia, should just have that in the back of their mind. If it's a family with a multi-generational history, they will have been affected by that. And it's just really important that people be aware of that.
I think that's so important to mention. Absolutely. let's round up a little bit. So what we normally do is we end these podcasts with quick fire questions. So the first one is, and we spoke about GCSE biology, but thinking more about the MRC PCH, are there any exam questions that might pop up about haemophilia?
You probably know better than me because it's not an exam I have much to do with because of the very specialised nature of my job, but I would be pretty certain that the question would be either around the non-accidental injury overlap with could this be haemophilia? I think it's terribly unlikely to be anything other than haemophilia. Yeah. And the other, I think the other likely thing would be the presentation of a boy with a swollen joint and it being in the differential.
Yeah. And I think you might also, in the part 1B, so the TAS exam, you might get some sciencey questions about clotting cascades and factors and things like that. Yeah. So second question, are there any useful resources that you would recommend?
So I guess anybody who's interested in bleeding disorders, sort of generally, not just haemophilia, the national body, which is the United Kingdom Haemophilia Centre Doctors Organisation, or UKHCDO, has a website to which are attached guidelines, including diagnosis and management of neonates and around delivery of potentially affected mums. Mm. So there's a guideline on those. And some of them are crossover shared with the British Society of Haematology guidelines. So if you look up either of those groups, you will be able to pick out those guidelines, which be quite a good overview.
Amazing. I will link them down below. And I will link that position paper as well that we spoke about earlier. Finally, to wrap things up, what are your takeaway learning points?
So I think, again, probably as I said at the start, these are rare conditions. But as a paediatrician, you may be the person that picks this up and that can make a giant difference to a child. And their chance of surviving to diagnosis, that sounds very dramatic, but it really, you know, and particularly in the context of intracerebral bleed. So I think that would be my first point. If you have a baby or a small child in front of you with an intracerebral bleed where there is no clear reason for that, absolutely get a clotting screen. Make sure it is viable. So if it's difficult, take, repeat it. If it doesn't make sense, repeat it and pick up the phone as soon as you can if you think there's any chance of that child having a severe bleeding disorder. The second one would be beware of the child that keeps coming back with small bleeds. So cut lip, you know, bit of a nosebleed. If it's a recurring thing, particularly in a family where they're sort of, listen to the parents. I mean, we know that all in pediatrics. They're seeing it. They've got an older child. This is different from my older two children. And remember that just because they have three sons who clearly are fine, they can have the fourth one that has haemophilia. So again, if you're seeing a pattern, if you see a child that appears to be bleeding, even if you're getting a clotting screen that looks normal, pick up the phone.
Yeah, pick up the phone, talk to your friendly local haematologist, and always listen to parents.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mary, thank you so, so very much for talking to us today.
Not at all. Great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Master the MRC PCH. We would love to get your feedback on the podcast and any ideas you may have for future episodes. You can find a link to the feedback page in the episode description or email us at digital.learning@gosh.nhs.uk. If you want to find out more about the work of the GOSH Learning Academy, you can find us on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can also visit our website at www.gosh.nhs.uk and search Learning Academy. We have lots of exciting new podcasts coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you enjoy this episode and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.